This is Poured Over, a show about stories presented by the booksellers of Barnes & Noble.
I'm Miwa Messer. I'm the producer and host of Poured Over. And Karis Davies has written this sublime, tiny, propulsive, amazing novel about language and isolation. And I didn't want it to end. I really did not want to leave this book. I didn't want to leave these characters. And I think it's all of, what, 160 pages? And I'm so excited to have this conversation with you. But can I ask where Clear started for you?
You can. It's actually one of those questions in the past when people have asked me, you know, where did this story come from or that novel? I've always said, I don't know. But with Clear, it was, you know, something very specific. I live in Edinburgh, and there's a beautiful National Library here, and I like to work sometimes in the reading room there. And one at the end of a pretty bad day of writing in the lovely old reading room there, I got up to take a break and I was browsing the shelves and I came across two sort of battered volumes about the size of a modern hardback book. I started reading them and it turned out they were a two-volume dictionary of an extinct language called Norn, which I had never heard of at that point. And Norn used to be spoken on the islands of Orkney and Shetland, way in the far north of Scotland. But the islands were pawned by the Danish king to Scotland in the middle of the 15th century. And thereafter, Norn started to die out and it was pushed out by Scots. So I had this dictionary of about 10,000 words, which had been preserved, gathered at the end of the 1890s. And I was just enchanted by the richness and specificity of these words. I mean, as you might expect, there were loads of words to do with the sea and the sky and clouds and mist and fog and whatnot, but also really specific words to do with states of emotion, like there's a word for a sudden feeling of powerlessness or the last drink before you die. And so I kind of lived with this dictionary for about a decade, just going back to it, writing down words, thinking about them. And I knew I would write about it, but for ages, I didn't know what the story was going to be. So that's how it started with the language.
We're going to give listeners a little bit of background, but obviously we're staying away from spoilers in this conversation. It's 1843, and Scotland's in an upheaval of sorts. Mm-hmm. There's a schism in the church, but there's also... It sounds like the economy is not doing well for a lot of folks in and around Scotland. And even the landowners are sort of, you know, making decisions because they're pinched, right? And we've got a minister who's taken a job that he doesn't particularly want, but he's broke. He's left the church. He's going out on his own. He's taken a job that's essentially evicting a longtime resident of one of these islands. It's really tight and it's really tense. And obviously you have a very small cast. I mean, it's really these two men. There's another person that we're not really going to reference in this conversation. But when did you find them?
So the first was Ivar, the inhabitant of this remote island. And he, fairly early on, I could kind of see him on this remote island. And I was pretty sure that he was the last speaker of this vanishing language and that conceivably he might, if he'd been very isolated, he could be alive in the middle of the 19th century. And this kind of dropped me into, as you say, this sort of tumultuous moment in history, two really massive things going on in Scottish society. One, the Highland clearances, where, as you say, Scottish landowners were evicting their small unprofitable tenants and placing them with sheep. And secondly, in the church, which is the reason John is poor, because I'd been thinking, well, I had this feeling that Ivar he's in some sort of danger. And I think that was because his language was endangered, made me feel that his whole existence was under threat. So when I realized, well, this is, you know, there are the clearances and there's a suspicion in the church, so who is evicting him? Well, that's how I came to John Ferguson. Right. He needs the money. So even though it's a sort of slightly morally dubious thing to be doing,
he makes a choice. And at one point, he has to travel 800 miles by boat. And when you're talking about 1843, 800 miles by boat, 800 round trip, but still 400 miles in a boat in 1843 is not my idea of fun. It's fun to read about, sure, but I'm quite happy I was never that person. And he's discombobulated. Sort of the minute he gets to this island, he has no idea what to expect. He gets injured. And this sort of, pardon what I'm about to say, but this knits his story in very tightly with Ivers. And the two of them develop sort of a relationship built around not necessarily understanding each other. And it's a little bit like a play in some ways. The dialogue obviously is different, but you're pushing the story forward.
That's really interesting that you say that, because I think I wrote short stories for a long time, first novel, and I think short story writers tend to be dramatists, maybe more than most novelists. You know, you're very much in the present moment. You haven't got much truck with backstory. You know, the pluperfect tense is pretty much forbidden. What we're learning of the characters, that is through, you know, it's through gesture and what they say and how they say it and what they do and what they don't do, rather than sort of, you know, big thought bubbles that on the page, as it were. So it's all very spare.
Well, and watching these two figure out what the world means, it's like watching the language unfold is so dramatic. And that's not necessarily what someone might expect when they see sort of the log line for this novel, right? Like, these two men, what's going to happen? But it ultimately, for me, was always about the language and how I, as the reader, was making my way through the story of these two men that I just never would have encountered otherwise. And I liked being uncertain. I liked being sort of off kilter because I didn't have the language either. You've set West, your first novel, third book, but first novel, in similar, slightly earlier decade of the 1800s as well. And I'm wondering what it is about the 1800s that sort of makes you want to spend time there as the writer, because the language is different. The culture is different. It's not just the difference between America and some island between Scotland and Norway. We're talking about a wildly different moment in time.
Wildly different. And, you know, you have to, before you do anything, you're crossing 200 years in time, let alone the space. But I mean, I rarely write about a world that's recognizably mine somehow, even though I'm, you know, as a novelist, you're always sort of dwelling in your own obsessions and anxieties and so on. But I need to inhabit somebody else. I need to inhabit a very different place. And that place is often pretty remote, pretty wild. And I think that's because, you know, the kind of stuff, all the other stuff of life and the business, that it just has to kind of fall away. And we're left with this really quite elemental struggle. And invariably, I seem to end up with two people. I mean, in West and in Clear, they're two pairs of men from wildly different backgrounds who are sort of thrust together and have to figure things out. And the language thing is interesting because in West, which is about an English settler who heads off into the unexplored territories beyond the river looking for woolly mammoths, who he knows that they're still alive. And he has a Native American guide and he never makes any attempt at all to learn this boy's language, because he barely sees him. Whereas in Clear, it's very different. John Ferguson he's thrust into this life that he has no understanding of. He knows about the clearances principle and he's observed them happening, but it's only now that he's sort of up close and really personal with Ivar. And there's a real, as they sort of get to know each other, there's a real sort of a longing to kind of really try and grasp the language, but that's so hard. You know, language is like birdsong. It's designed so insiders can communicate, but it's also designed to keep outsiders out. And I've always been fascinated in, as an outsider, trying to overcome that. So that's sort of John's project in a way. He's trying to learn enough of Iver's language, but it's without really knowing what he's doing, and it, without giving too much away, it sort of creeps up on him.
One of the details you give John, though, is this bit of his story where he's trying to translate the Gospels into Scots so that his congregants can actually understand what they're hearing. And in 1843 or 1840, whenever he's doing this exactly, that's a radical idea to be able to interpret the church, which is sort of the seat of the power in this particular situation, directly, right? Like to be able to experience it on your own. And I thought, oh, okay, so here's a guy who totally understands language. And let's say he just gets really flummoxed a lot. He gets a little flummoxed, but watching him figure out like the 67 words for different shades of the ocean and different behaviors of the ocean.
It's true. I mean, I knew very early on, I didn't want this to be a sort of, oh, did you know the Inuit had 100 different words for snow? You know, there was always, I always wanted to go a lot further than that. So, you know, one of the challenges of writing the book was to have them sort of very slowly begin to understand each other in a kind of pidgin way, but also to get some of these wonderful nuances would allow John to glimpse the world through Iver's eyes instead of his own. That was a challenge, but as so often with what you're writing, you know, it's the difficult things, the challenges that sort of throw up the best things. So the lapses in understanding, the gaps of understanding were the moments that threw up moments of possibility.
But you are also writing about extinction, right? Mm. In both novels, you're writing about it, and not just the woolly mammoths, but you're talking about extinction of smaller pieces of culture, or certainly the native population in the U.S. in the West in the 1800s, which is obviously not a small thing. Clear is a really interesting way for me to think about how we approach land, how we approach the idea of home. I mean, because part of me was also very much judging the landowner who's trying to get Iver out of there. And I'm like, well, dude, you're clearly extended beyond your means. That's on you, not this guy who lives 400 miles away from you with his blind cow, a handful of chickens, and a couple of sheep. It seems like, you know, we keep looping back on ourselves in a way, right?
Yeah, completely. I mean, I'd finished this book, obviously, before Ukraine. It was very much on my mind. And what fascinated me about the disappearance of the language was, and when the writer of this dictionary went to collect these words, he found that when he went to visit old people to say, well, what do you remember of the old language? They were sort of embarrassed to tell him, because the old language was, you know, it was the language of the peasants, and people were, and I'm Welsh. I mean, I grew up in Wales, and it's different now. The language has really been revived. But when my grandparents and my parents were growing up, you know, the aspiration was all about speaking English. You know, you didn't want Welsh. So that's part of that vanishing. And in Scotland at this time, it really was just a case of a whole swathe of society being surplus to requirements.
I mean, even John, you talk about how when he's small, he's raised speaking English as well. And if it weren't for the housekeeper, he never would have learned Scots at all. And it does, when I hear people losing their language or being taken out of their language or forced to use a dominant language that is not necessarily theirs, it makes my heart hurt, makes me ache because language is such a fundamental piece of anyone's identity. And to have someone come in and say, well, we're going to replace how you approach the world with words that may or may not actually have meaning for you, poignant.
Yes, and that's this great gap between John and Iver, is that Iver has these so many very specific words for his world. And to John, they're just this kind of blurry, you know. Iber, for instance, you know, he has so many words for when the sea is in tumult. And to John, he just thinks, well, it's just a rough sea, you know, doesn't have any other vocabulary for that.
And I grew up on the Atlantic, and knowing that the Atlantic behaves differently, you know, depending on the month, depending on the week, depending on the season, depending on a million different things, like never, ever, ever take the ocean for granted, because that is just not a good place to be. But watching these two men sort of figure it out, but also I think of John as sort of, well, he's a version of the city, right? And Iver obviously has been living in isolation for quite some time, but he's very self-sufficient. But we're meeting him after illness, and he's vulnerable in a way that I don't think he's ever seen himself or felt himself be. And I would imagine that for a dude like that, who's used to taking care of himself to the extreme, that set him up to be open to having another person on the island in a way that he wouldn't have. Like, if he were okay,
yeah,
he might be more prickly.
I think it's definitely his illness definitely heightened his sense of, well, maybe, you know, his sense of his own mortality and thinking about dying alone. You know, mm-hmm. I think we all die alone, but we hope that we'll die surrounded by people we love. And all the people Iver love are either dead or they've gone. So I think he's, as you say, he's very vulnerable and susceptible, I think, at this moment when John arrives, and be the first moment when he feels seen by another human being is almost too much to bear.
But also, one of the reasons I love Iver is the way he appears here is the fact that men like him don't often get to be vulnerable in the context of literature or art or film or anything else. There's always this idea that you are the grizzled guy who's going to survive no matter what. And you've given him his humanity in a way that not every writer would have done. And I got very attached to him. I got very attached to all of the characters in this book. And I know you said Iver came to you first, but yeah. Is he fully a creature of your imagination, or is this also a little bit of research?
No, he's completely. I tend not to. I mean, if I spent a year reading about the Highland Clearances and the split in the church, I never would have written this novel. I tend to write the story I want to write with fairly minimal research. Just sort of, you know, I might check a few things along the way, but a lot of the historical research I sort of do after the event. I sort of want to get the emotion of the story. John came a little bit out of, I found some wonderful letters in the archive from a Free Church pastor to his wife. He was writing home while he was sort of rushing around the city just before they split with the church. That helped me a bit with John. John was the most difficult of all three characters, I think. You know, I think, because, you know, somebody with that degree of faith and that kind of stern Presbyterian faith, I think, you know, that was a lot to reach across a distance of, so, you know, such a distance in time. And I think none of us can really grasp that kind of real religiosity. I think that's really hard for us.
I was raised Unitarian. I have no concept of, no, I mean, from an academic and an intellectual standpoint, sure. But I appreciated the way he evolved. Again, he has a vulnerability to him that maybe a man who's educated in the way he's educated, or certainly in the church, what have you, would be allowed to have more vulnerability on the page or on the screen. But I feel like both of these men are allowed to be human in a way that serves the characters as well as the story.
I think that, I mean, for what, ever reason, I do seem to be very drawn to writing about quite mixed up men. You know, they're sort of, they are courageous, but they're also cowardly. They're intelligent, but they're also naive. They're curious, but they also tend to be pretty blinkered about themselves. You know, find themselves in these situations that they're really totally unprepared to deal with. But it did strike me the other day, actually thinking about all three of my novels, that all of these flawed men are all loved by good women. So in West, Cy is adored by his daughter Bess, who always sees the best in him and never in him. And in the Mission House, Hilary Bird has a sister, and also there's a character called Priscilla who doesn't return his love, but she really appreciates his value and what he has to teach her. And in Clear, it's Mary who sees that in spite of John's sort of stern Presbyterianism, he is sincere and loving and a good man who's trying to find his way.
She's a great, great character with a really good story arc, but I'm also kind of dancing away from some of Mary. But the ending of this novel, and obviously we're not going to reveal the ending here, but the ending is really satisfying. And I'm wondering if you sort of knew where you were going.
No.
Okay. Okay.
Definitely not.
Okay. No.
I never know where I'm going. I wouldn't be interested in writing the story if I knew that.
I'm so happy to know that, because the ending feels so organic and smart and unexpected in a way that I'm delighted to know that you just kind of ended up there as well, because it works. It just 196 pages, really tightly written, but you're hitting all of these huge schisms in culture and community, and also questioning masculinity. I mean, some other writers might have taken a few more pages, sure. But it seems like you're happiest writing short and tight. I mean, beyond the short stories, I mean, all of your novels are very, very tightly structured.
Yeah. I mean, I write a lot more. You know, there's a lot of rubble on the floor. And, you know, it's very much a question of trial and error. And, you know, you add a sentence here, a paragraph, or a page, or a chapter, or a few chapters. And so much of the time I end up thinking there's better without. You know, there's so much power in a single very short line in the right place, or, you know, or juxtaposing, say, John's point of view and Mary's point of view, and just let the reader see the space in between. So
can we talk about influences, though? Because your voice is so uniquely yours. And you and I sort of share a love of this novel called In the Distance by Hernan Diaz, which is his first novel. And it's a very wild Western that I quite love. But I feel like you're pulling from lots of different places. And I'm wondering if we can talk about those.
Sure. I started writing fiction when I moved to Chicago in my mid-30s. And having not read very many North American short stories, I discovered Flannery O'Connor and Eudora Welty and John Cheever and Bernard Malamud, and then some of the more recent ones, Laurie Moore, Miranda July, and Annie Proulx. And I just thought, this is what I want to do. And I think with all of those writers, there's always tragedy and comedy. There's so much pain, but they're funny, and the sense of place is always fantastic, and the character is always brilliant. And those definitely have been an influence. And then I think also, you know, the Odyssey, the Iliad, the Bible, all those sort of big things that we should have always been knocking around are sort of very much there too. But, you know, for someone who writes such short books, I also love the big 19th century novels. I know a lot of people don't anymore, but I love Dickens. I love his compassion. I love his fury against cruel institutions.
I have a copy of The Mill and the Floss up there that I picked up after Michael Cunningham and I sat down to talk about Day, because there's a sibling relationship in there. And he's like, oh yeah, that's totally me in conversation with George Eliot in The Mill and the Floss. And I'm like, that's the second George Eliot that I bought that I haven't yet gotten to, but I will. It's right above my shoulder. But I understand that. I do think, given how you feel about your characters, there is that sort of 19th century weight to the story and what you're doing.
I mean, George Eliot, you know, Dickens, they're so enmeshed in those big, you know, the politics and the big social upheavals. And I like to be in there too. And that's when a story begins for me, is when I find a moment in time which feels difficult and complicated, and that's a bit dangerous as well.
So for you then, the writing is in the rewriting and the cutting, it sounds like. It's not just sitting down and creating the piece itself. It's going back and chipping away at it until you have the thing that you want.
Yes. So it's more sort of, I tend to sort of, I write a lot. So once I have my character, I'll just write a lot about them and different scenes. And then I don't really have coherent drafts. It just sort of eventually coalesces until I do. And then it's, yeah, chipping away.
Having read Clear and reread West recently, I'm just thinking about how tightly written they are, how clear the characters are, and I'm just thinking, huh, that's not exactly how I would have expected these to have come into the world, but I'm just very glad they're here. That was really, yeah. And again, coming back to this idea of sort of wilderness and what happens and what it means and how we try to change it. I mean, you had me thinking about Inland by Taya Obrecht, and you had me thinking about The Vaster Wilds by Lauren Groff. And okay, so I'm not a stoner person, John Williams. I prefer Butcher's Crossing. I mean, all props to the people who love stoner. I know that's a thing, but I'd rather be out in the West doing ridiculous things with him. And I just love the idea that all of you sit in this line, right, of this sort of modern interpretation of wilderness.
I came to the United States in the early 90s, and I had never been to the American West. And I think it's hard for an American to quite get how amazing that is for a European to see the American West for the first time. The scale of it, the grandeur, is just overwhelming. So that stayed with me for a long time. And I do remember going to see the movie Django, and there's a scene in that where they're sort of trudging through the snow in the middle of nowhere. And I do think that was a kind of tiny seed for the writing of West, just a feeling, I want to go there. I don't know what the story is, but I want to go there.
It is. If you've ever been to the mountains in Utah, or we have an amazing national park system in the US, and but also New Mexico, like there's some wild terrain in the United States, and it's just what it is. And it is, they're really... is nothing like it. And also, I mean, you come from a country that is tiny. I mean, all of the United Kingdom fits in Texas, and that's Wales and Scotland and Ireland and England all fits in Texas. And I think sometimes it's easy to forget the scale. But again, you put a guy like John on a boat for 400 miles in 1843. This is like Darwin and the Beagle finally set sail like 10 years before.
Right.
The events in Clear, and like 15 years after what happens in West. So I love this continuum that you've created.
Yes, I love that about, you know, Darwin, and there was this whole thing of Cy looking for, you know, maybe the mammoths are out there, and our ideas about evolution were so totally unformed.
And the mammoths, I mean, I remember the first time I read West, I thought, mammoths. Okay. And then this time when I reread it, I was like, yeah, of course. Of course. It just makes perfect sense that this is the guy that would do this. And I'm still a little mad that he left his kid behind, but I'll get over it.
It's funny. I mean, I would sometimes at festivals, I'd have people saying, really? I mean, what sort of, who would ever leave their child for 2 years to go off into the West looking for mammoths? Then I've just finished reading a book about a Swedish balloon expedition in the late 1890s to go to the North Pole, when they didn't really know very much about ballooning. They all left their family. I just think, really, just have a look at history. You'll see that it happens all the time.
I mean, honestly, that's what I was thinking. I like Bess as a character. I think she's a very good kid. I think she's also, you know, very wide-eyed. But as you were saying, you know, who goes? I'm like, Cyrus Bellman. Dude, just like, he was never going to not go. And he was never going to, you know, sort of not have those adventures. And I feel sort of the same way about John. Yeah, he took a job because he was broke. You know, he's still the guy who figured out, okay, I'll take this job for 16 pounds, which, you know, I'm sure at the time was more money than not, but sounds like such a tiny, tiny amount of money.
Well, I think, you know, there's a lot going on under the surface. I think you begin to see that, again, without giving up too much. You know, he's sort of embroiled in his, he calls it his glossary, you know, the words in Ivor's language that he's writing down and trying to learn. I think you sense a complicated person underneath that or it's not quite as it might seem.
Do you miss the men? Do you miss Ivor and John? I sort of feel like you might.
Once I've finished.
Yeah.
You know, I do miss my characters, but I know that when I'm done with them, I am done with them. I couldn't go back, and you eventually get to a point where, yeah, now I'm sort of stepping back from this.
Does that mean you've started the new thing? The next book?
I have sort of two new things, but usually I have a couple of things on the go at once and I just wait until one of them sort of, you know, bubbles a bit more to the surface. So, but yeah, I'm in that sort of quite chaotic state at the moment.
Are you sticking with novels, or are you thinking maybe short stories might come back?
I think this feels like a novel, but, you know, never say never. Any story is as long or as short as it needs to be, and you just have to see.
So we keep dancing around Mary for reasons that readers will find out, but she's a great character. I mean, I've mentioned Bess in West. I really like that little girl. She's all of, what, 11? But you're writing, both of these books are set in a moment in history, doesn't matter which side of the Atlantic we're on, where men really do dominate the conversation. Mm-hmm. It's absolutely, everything is driven by what men want to do and how men see the world and where men think we should go, mm-hmm. and what we should do. And I'm wondering how you navigate, though, that space of stepping back in time and knowing where sort of the balance is. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no, it's really interesting. I mean, I think there's a very natural desire for a contemporary writer writing about women at any time in the past. Mm-hmm. Maybe give them more agency than historically they might have had. What right. I like to do is to have my women, my girls, in their moment, and have them navigate that and push against the very, very real constraints that were there at the time. So Bess, within her very narrow confines, I mean, she's 10 at the beginning, she's 12 at the end, but she is very... She's plucky, she's independent, she does something pretty amazing at the end and then doesn't tell anybody about it ever. And to me, that was, she operated within the boundaries of what was possible for her. And the same with Mary. I mean, Mary is older, Mary's in her early 40s. She never expected to marry anyone. She doesn't particularly like men. She finds them quite irritating. They're always telling her what to do and what to think and what to read. And then she meets John, and, you know, she falls in love. And she's always navigating this quite sort of tricky line between respecting his desire and sincerity in what he thinks he should do, and mostly keeping to herself her misgivings, but sharing them a little bit, but mostly keeping them to herself. But then, well, again, I'm not going to give too much away, but within the bounds of possibility, she is brave and very pragmatic and practical. I love her.
Yeah, I do too. We'll just have our Mary fan conference in the corner here. She really is a great character, and just the way everything plays out in Clear, I know I said this earlier in the show, but the language, and it's the combination of your prose and watching John and Ivor figure out what language is, but it's also my own connection to language, right? Like, this to me was a really intriguing escape into a world that I never would have thought about otherwise. It reminded me a lot of Paul Harding's This Other Eden in sort of tone and timbre, slightly different in scope, but I mean, you're sitting sort of in a continuum of wilderness and change and what happens when sort of the outside world decides it wants a thing. So I'm really excited for readers to get their hands on Clear. And I'm so glad we had a chance to hang out. Thank you so much for making the time. We're playing with time differences here. We're playing with daylight savings, all sorts of wildness. But sometimes technology is your friend, right? Sometimes we get to do really cool things. Karis Davies, thank you so much for joining us on Poured Over.
Thank you so much for having me.
Hello, readers. It's time for another TBR Top Off. We're going to recommend a couple of fantastic books to pick up when you stop in for your copy of Clear by Karis Davies. I'm Mark. I'm coming to you from my Barnes & Noble in Cincinnati, and I'm joined by one of my favorite people in the universe, my book buddy, Jamie, in Leawood, Kansas. And Jamie, I think I'm going to have you kick things off because I love listening to you talk about books.
Same, friend. It's the highlight of my day. I mean it. Okay. I think if the sort of fierce independence in Clear is what's compelling to you, if that's what you find compelling, I have a wonderful but oftentimes uncomfortable novel to recommend, and that's Unsettled Ground by Claire Fuller. In fact, for this one, we're going to head back to the United Kingdom, to modern but very rural England, and a pair of twins named Jeannie and Julius, who are 51 years old and who live with their mother in isolation. This is modern day, okay, but the three of them live, you know, cut off from the world. There's no phones or internet, no bank accounts. They are quite poor and have been living a simple life in this cottage together for decades, apart from society, in what I think many people would feel is abject poverty, but which they have accepted and learned to work with. They've not finished school. They have very few skills beyond gardening to grow their own free food and keeping the house and mending their clothes and making music together. And they have a major distrust of government and literally no understanding of finance at all. The twins don't. So when their mother dies, they have nowhere to go. And they really only trust each other because they've spent all their time together. And so it turns out that their mother's been keeping a lot of secrets from them. They don't own their cottage. They don't own their home. And their landlord is now evicting them now that the mother is gone. And now they're going to be forced to interact with the world at large, who up until now have kind of viewed them as the odd family that lives out at the edge of town, you know, something that they might ignore or, you know, at worst times gossip about. And now these twins understand that their family life has been pretty dysfunctional. And they see when they're confronted with other people that they just aren't the same, right? And they begin to unravel a little bit as they work out how to connect with people, which is something that everyone wants, right? In some way, everybody wants to connect, wants connection, but they're repulsed by many aspects of modern life. And what they do, you know, what do they know? They don't know anything about TV dinners or television or ordering food from an app to be delivered to your home. This is not the world that they live in. And so Fuller goes over all this in really exacting and lovely detail. It's beautifully written. And one of the most lovely scenes in the book, which is incredibly sad, is that of their mother, the twins' mother, Dot, narrating her own death to them. So yes, it's bleak and it's often sad, but there is a lot of beauty in this too. And it explores kind of the simple pleasures that a lot of us take for granted in our modern life, which is something that really adds a touch of beauty to the story. So anyway, that is Unsettled Ground by Claire Fuller. Mark, what do you have for us today?
I love that you recommended Claire Fuller because she is not afraid to get a little kind of grimy and a little unsettling, almost like a Shirley Jackson successor, which is perfect because I was thinking about Clear, which very excited to read this book. It sounds fantastic. I love the idea of isolation that can be told in such a beautiful way. I love the marriage of sense of space and place with how that intersects with a human psyche. And it made me think about a book that I just finished very recently called At the Edge of the Woods by Catherine Bromwick. It is, again, it feels almost like she and Claire Fuller and Shirley Jackson could live in this like very beautifully written, but maybe potentially spooky place. It's a novel where I think the sense of where this takes place, especially the natural part of the world, is so beautifully written that you just get consumed, which is very much by design by this author. And I can't say completely why, but I'll try to skirt spoilers as I go. So we spend time with Laura, who is a woman who has moved into this ramshackle cabin at the edge of the woods of this Italian village. Time period is a little murky. It doesn't really matter when this takes place, but it feels a little old in the best way. There is a reason that she has moved into this home by herself and how the villagers are reacting to a woman living alone and in the woods by herself in a cabin. There are reasons for that that are slowly and gently revealed throughout the novel, but she really just needs to be by herself. She lives off the land. She is basically bringing all of this, bringing herself up and her means up just from the woods around her. There are punctuated points where she's going into the village to pick up supplies, usually met with a very kind of cold wariness from the villagers. They don't really know what to make of this woman who, first of all, isn't even Italian. Secondly, is alone and chooses to live in this cabin that has its own set of history and this own kind of dark mark attached to it. But Laura doesn't really care. She needed to get away, and this is the best spot for her to do so. But the woods and the mountains outside of her home start awakening something in her. She becomes very galvanized and unnervingly immersed in nature, in the way that she views things, in the things that she is seeing and the things that she's smelling, in the way that nature is providing things for her, but also potentially pulling her down a path that might be a bit dangerous. So as her mental state starts to fuse with the woods around her, the village folks' superstitions start to kindle. That turns into a bit of an unraveling that has sort of a haunting finale. But it's really the voice and the sense of place and the look of the natural world from a very isolated, kind of damaged point of view that really makes this book sing. I think people who like, you know, maybe Shirley Jackson's kind of trademark leaning towards madness, or maybe Richard Powers's beautiful ability to write about nature in his fiction, I think would really have a great time with At the Edge of the Woods by Catherine Bromwick. So please check it out. But guess what? That's all the time we have for today. Thanks so much for tuning in to Pour It Over. Please make sure to give us a rating and subscribe so you don't miss an episode. You can also follow us on our socials at Barnes & Noble. I am Mark. You can follow my home store at BN Westchester. Jamie, where can we find you?
I'm Jamie. You can follow my home store at BN Leewood KS.
Thanks for tuning in, everybody. Happy reading. Bye.
Thank you for listening. Pour It Over is a Barnes & Noble production. To help other readers find us, please rate and review the show wherever you listen to podcasts.